listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television by the Free Speech TV Network on Dish Network, DirecTV, and hundreds of cable systems nationwide. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer, is on the line with us. The attorney with Levin Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio, the host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringofireradio.com, and Ring of Fire TV on Free Speech TV. Hey, Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you doing?
Good. I understand that Eric Holder is today announcing that he is going to resign as soon as a fill-in can be found for him. I'm curious your take on this. You've been fairly outspoken about Eric Holder.
My take is hallelujah. That's my take. This is a guy that from the word go has never been able to get rid of his attachment to his corporate defense firm, Covington & Burling. It's been a firm that this is what people missed. And truthfully, you have to understand this started with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had kinship with big silk stocking defense firms. I mean, the Rose firm where his wife worked was one of the biggest defense firms in the South, in the Southern United States at one point. And so he's used to working. He was used to having a kinship with attorneys that came from these silk stocking firms that represented the Exxons and the Mercks.
So this is when you say defense, you're not talking about a criminal defense attorney who's helping out poor people.
No.
You're talking about defending big polluters, big corporations, big banks.
Defending big banks, big insurance companies, big corporations. That's really all Eric Holder has ever known. Eric Holder came from a setting where they defended Philip Morris. You recall my discussion about secondhand smoke a couple of weeks ago where we talked about how they created an industry to make it sound like secondhand smoke was not a problem and they would go to these biostitute brokers. Well, this law firm was really a biostitute broker. This is a firm that would go out, for example, and find scientists that would say that secondhand smoke won't hurt you. They also worked for Blackwater. They worked for Halliburton. They worked. They got paid a lot of money by these corporations. They worked for Bank of America. They worked for the phosphate industry and virtually every major phosphate company in the country at some point. Copper mines, anywhere there was pollution going on, anywhere there was Wall Street doing some kind of hustle, anytime mom and pop pension programs were being stolen from, the law firm that Eric Holder worked for, Covington Burling, was always there. They continue to be there. He's going to go back to work with him. I understand that he is actually building out a huge penthouse condominium right next to the Covington Burling firm in Washington, D.C. So it's pretty apparent that he was making so much money there before he's going to go back. Look, he was working for Chiquita Banana. They were paying him huge amounts of money. That case was where Chiquita Banana was paying terrorists to protect shipments of their goods. And basically what they were militia thugs who were not beyond killing people, beating people up, doing whatever kind of heavy-handedness they needed to do. The Covington Burling firm was there for them. Worked for the Vioxx folks. Vioxx was a product that killed just thousands of Americans. Worked for the Merck people when they got into trouble. So what we've done with Eric Holder, you see, is we had this notion that he was the person that he talked like, that when he came in, he was all about, I care about the little man. He's never had any kinship with the little man. The only thing that he's made any inroads into, and it's only because he was forced and cajoled, was voting rights issues. He waited to the last minute, if you recall, to jump into that fight. He has not been, in any sense of the word, an attorney general that gives a damn about claimants or the little people. He is completely the silk stocking country club lawyer that Obama appointed because Obama, in a lot of ways, thinks just like Eric Holder on a lot of these issues. That's why Wall Street, that stole $3 trillion from the American public, was never prosecuted. Because Holder was one of the guys that used to represent the Wall Street folks, the Bank of America folks.
Right.
So this is great for America. Of course, I don't expect much difference in the next appointment by this president. He's wholly owned by Wall Street, completely owned by Wall Street. So we're not going to see much difference in the next attorney general.
Some of the names being floated are Donald Varelli, I believe he's the U.S. attorney, or he's the guy. What's that job that Elena Kagan used to have, where you argue before the Supreme Court on behalf of the administration?
Solicitor General.
Solicitor General. I think that's his position. Duval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts. There've been a few names kicked around. Do you have any favorites or O's?
I haven't even started looking yet, but it won't make any difference because anything that progressives would want. They're not going to have an attorney general that will go after the Wall Street crooks. They're not going to have an attorney general that will really aggressively go after polluters. They're not going to have an attorney general that separates themselves from silk stocking America. It's simply where we are, even with this president that ran on being somehow, he convinced us at one point that he was actually a populist. So there's not ever going to be, we're not going to see any big change. Ramsey Clark was the last real attorney general that really gave a damn about the working man, about the consumer out there. And we haven't seen that for a long time.
Interesting. Well, we'll keep an eye on this. The bunch of other things going on. One of the things I thought was interesting at the UN yesterday was that when President Obama led the UN, he got basically everybody in the world. I mean, all the countries on the Security Council, which isn't everybody in the world, but it's basically the power core of the UN, to say yes, we are going to criminalize joining ISIS. This is a very different approach from George W. Bush. After 9/11, the Taliban came to Bush and, the Washington Post reported on this and said, we will arrest bin Laden and his merry band and turn them over to a neutral third country for trial, if you would like. And George W. Bush said, no, we'd rather just bomb your country. And so Bush's response was, let's have a couple of wars. That sounds like fun. And it'll, as he told his biographer the year before he was elected, if he was a war president, he was more likely to be able to privatize Social Security. He'd have the political capital. Mm. Instead, Obama is saying, let's do this the way it should have been done right after 9/11. Declare these guys criminals and have the whole world hunt them down using their police agencies. This seems to me like a good thing.
It's very creative. It's very good. In defense of this president, these news sites that are coming out in comparing what this president is doing right now to what Bush did is just almost laughable. Listen, this is a president that understood that at least before anything happened, he had to have at least the makings of what looked like a coalition. And actually, it was a very important coalition. I mean, you're talking about the Arab Emirates. You're talking about Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. He went out and he did what he was supposed to do. And that was to say, we have other people that, A, had sure better pay some money to make this happen. B, when boots get on the ground, which it's going to happen, Tom. I mean, these people saying there will be no boots on the ground is fantasy work. But the point being, this is very different from what we saw with George Bush. He at least is trying to approach this like a statesman, and I'm satisfied to see that. I hope that will continue, although there's no happy ending to this.
Yeah, I fear not. Excellent point. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
It was great seeing you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
ringoffireradio.com is the website for Mike Papantonio's show, his show on radio and on television as well. We'll be back. And welcome back. Pap, you're still with us?
I am.
Okay, so what's coming up this weekend here on Free Speech TV on Ring of Fire Television?
Well, I have Howard Nation is going to tell us who's behind the media's push for another war, how it's happening, how the defense contractors are lining up like vultures. It's fairly disgusting. You know what? It's happening right there in your backyard in D.C. There's more defense contractors in D.C. than anywhere in the country right now. I have author David Nywert in Seattle. He's going to discuss the right wing's militia plans to block border areas in the Southwest and how what a miserable failure that's been, how it's become almost a laughable joke every time they say they're going to the borders to protect them. Nobody ever shows up. David Haynes is going to explain why the FDA has become a true, I mean, absolute true extension of Big Pharma. There's really, the votes are all in. There's no question. They absolutely work for Big Pharma right now. Author Greg Palast is going to discuss the climate marches that took place over the weekend and how it was so amazing that the corporate media paid no attention to it. Almost it was like a tree falling in the forest with nobody around. It was like a big yawn to the Sunday talk shows. So David Hirsch is going to join us and talk about how the government's trying to rein in payday lenders and the new cases of fraud that are beginning to surface against that industry. And then finally, we have Joe Cochette, who's going to explain the empirical data. What does the empirical data show 4 years after the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Citizens United? All of that is in. We can show you exactly what happened, how bad it is, how bad it hurt local politics. He's going to talk about that.
Sounds like a good show.
It is a good show, Tom. I think everybody will enjoy it.
Yeah. And what else is on your mind these days? What are the other topics you think are worth ranting about and sharing with people?
Well, I think one topic that we can't miss, I think, is this, and I know you've talked plenty about it. I saw the piece that you did on where in the hell was the media when 400,000 people were in the street. I don't think we can minimize what's happening there, Tom. What's happening is you have the large corporate-owned networks that are getting so much money from the industry, from the oil industry, from the energy industry, from all of the think tanks, from all of the political entities that are putting so much money into corporate advertising of one form or another. And so at what point, if we can't move the ball on something as serious as something that's melting our planet and is turning it into embers for our grandchildren, to the point to where we now know by the year 2100 that 50% of all of that we're going to have an extinction of 50% of the species on the planet. If we can't get corporate media to respond, then what you're doing, hopefully what I'm doing, what Free Speech TV is doing, their effort to grow, their effort to get this message out, we become much more important and we have a bigger responsibility to break through this idiocy that we see on Sunday talk shows on corporate media, where real news is not talked about, where we don't get the real story because there's so much money trying to convince the media not to tell the story. I face it every day with pharmaceutical cases, Tom, where I could have a case killing millions of people and corporate media won't report it because they get so much money from the industry.
Yeah, amazing stuff. And just apropos of that, Free Speech TV is in their fund drive now. 877-378-8669 is the number. Mike Papatonio, Pap, it's always wonderful having you on. Thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking. And we'll see you on TV here. 20 minutes past the hour. Attorney General Holder says he's going to go back to making millions. Yeah, that's the cynical take on it. I think Eric Holder has done some good stuff as AG. On the other hand, he's no Bobby Kennedy, although he invokes Bobby Kennedy, and you know, to his credit, I'd say. The Republican Governors Association, which Chris Christie was in charge of, maybe still is. Don't recall. But the Republican Governors Association got hacked. Actually, it might have been that it wasn't so much that they got hacked, but they just left a back door open. But one of these groups, and I think it was CREW, Melanie Sloan, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Government, CREW, looked at this and discovered that basically there was this long list of, you know, how much these Republican, these big corporations, literally from Aetna to Walmart, from A to W, big corporations giving money to the Republican Governors Association. And, you know, like with a $50,000 gift, you get to be in a dinner with these three governors. With a $100,000 gift, you get to have two dinners with these six governors, you know, whatever. And it's they're selling access. And we used to call this bribery. We used to call this, you know, corruption. In fact, you know, the federal judicial code of conduct is you have to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. Although the Supreme Court has said that doesn't count for us, right? We're not going to be part of that one. But now the Republican Governors Association has been outed on this stuff. Long piece by Jonathan Weissman yesterday in the New York Times. Maybe it's in today's print version. I'm not sure. I read it online. And one of the points that the New York Times article made about two-thirds of the way into it, which I thought was real interesting, was this is not illegal. And the Democrats are probably doing something very similar, although it appears that they're not dealing in such large amounts of money and they're not doing, you know, more money, more access kind of things. They're doing it in a little more laid-back fashion. But, you know, basically this is legal. Why is it legal? Because our Supreme Court has decided that corruption of our political system is not a problem. The corruption is always going to happen, ultimately, by the richest and most powerful people. And those are the people for whom the Supreme Court, or at least the five conservatives on the Supreme Court, work. And yes, they work for them. They go to the Koch brothers' parties and meetings. They speak at the Koch brothers' conferences, which is, you know, indirectly a way of helping the Koch brothers bring more billionaires in, raise more money, have more political impact. Particularly Thomas and Scalia. These guys are so corrupt that if the federal code of judicial standards, judicial ethics, which is applied to every federal judge in the country, was applied to the Supreme Court, Scalia and Thomas would have to resign or could be impeached or could be prosecuted. I mean, it's mind-boggling. You know, that is what's happening. Saudi Arabia beheading more people. The Washington Post has an article about how Saudi Arabia is, you know, they just routinely cut people's heads off. This is Wahhabist Islam. It comes out of Saudi Arabia. They have been exporting it for 150 plus years in an aggressive way for the last 70 years. And it's Wahhabist Islam, Wahhabist Sifali Islam, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but that is all about, you know, we're the only ones. You guys are we're going to chop your heads off. At what point do we say enough already? Oh, this is amazing. By the way, over the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, a federal judge has said, yep, Scott Walker gets to say 300,000 people in Wisconsin can't vote unless they get state ID. Okay, so there's a scramble, right? This is between now and Election Day, 6,000 people a day have to get their ID. And the state has said, okay, cool, we'll give it to you for free. Here's the catch. A, the state is not set up to produce 6,000 IDs a day. They're just not set up. And B, this is even more mind-boggling. In 48 of the state's 72 counties, an area that holds a full quarter of the state's adult population, the DMV is only open 2 days a week, exclusively on weekdays. So you can't get any ID on weekends. And if you work and have to take time off from work to get an ID, there's 2 days a week and good luck. You're going to be all day. You're going to be standing in line all day. This is just a vote. And the Republicans are betting, because they can't win elections based on the issues, they're betting that if they can keep those 300,000 people in Wisconsin, mostly people of color, people who are poor, people who are elderly, and students, if they can keep those people from voting, then the Republicans can hold on to the state legislature and the governor's office. This is their strategy. Prevent 300,000 people from voting. And there's no way that the DMV is going to issue 6,000 IDs a day between now and Election Day, especially given that in about a third of the state's counties, the DMV is only open 2 days a week on weekdays. really, really bizarre. We will be back, pick up your calls and some other news of the day right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And a little later on in the day, we're going to be getting into climate change and how it's exacerbating Ebola. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Another day, another shocking video showing a police officer, a white police officer, shooting an unarmed black man at point-blank range. This time down in Florida, the police officer is being charged with assault and has lost his job. Yeah, step by step, right? Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Hack, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
I always like it when you have Pap on. It's very enlightening.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
I had no idea. I had no idea, forgive my saying, that Holder was such a corporate whore.
Well, that's his background, and it informs, yeah. You know, when people scratch their head and go, well, you know, why didn't he put Jamie Dimon in jail? You know, it's probably because Jamie Dimon used to be a client of his or might be in the future.
Ding.
Yeah.
Anywho,
this is not, by the way, this is a problem that is easily addressed by, it was easily addressed by legislation back in 1973 and 74 that closed the revolving door and got money out of politics and held politicians accountable or people who would be in political or a point of office. And that legislation has been systematically dismantled by the Supreme Court. I'm sorry.
Gotcha. I think Pap ought to be the change he wishes to seek.
Let him run for AG. Yeah.
I don't know if he wants a job or not, but.
I don't think he wants it.
Told me about.
Yeah, I'm with you. He would make a great attorney general. Yeah, Hack. Thanks for the call. I think Wayne wants to make the same point in Chicago. Hey, Wayne.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Good. What's up, Wayne?
Yes, as far as Eric Holder's concerned, I just want to say thank God for Mike Papantonio because he always tells the truth. You know, this is like a surprise today that Eric Holder's leaving, but I was saying to myself, the next time I call Tom, I'm going to ask him, why is Eric Holder leaving Don Siegelman in jail?
Right.
That's way before today, before we even knew Eric Holder was going to resign.
Yeah.
So, you know, but anyway, what I really want to talk about is this Ebola thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, Tom, give me a little latitude here. I know you got other calls, but I'm going to make this quick.
Okay,
there's a doctor by the name of Cyril Broderick. He's an associate professor at Delaware State University. He's in the Department of Agricultural and Natural Resources. Now, he wrote an article in the Liberian paper, the main Liberian paper, which is called The Observer. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about that these diseases are a direct result of the U.S. Department of Defense biowarfare against Africans. This is a September 9th article. It says that there was a... bioweapons lab in Sierra Leone that the United States was operating a viral hemorrhagic fever bioterrorism research lab. And Sierra Leone finally closed the lab down, and Tulane University from New Orleans was actually doing testing at that lab when they closed it down. So, you know, another thing he says is that as far as the U.S. and most of the Western countries, they are the source for most viral or bacterial GMOs that are strategically designed as biological weapons. Yeah. And here's another thing, Tom. Last night I was listening to George Norrie. Mm-hmm. A guy called in. He said that he hasn't talked to his friend for 4 weeks. His friend is a healthcare worker over there where the Ebola virus is. And his friend was telling him he was afraid because the authorities knew that he knew that it wasn't Ebola virus. And his friend disappeared. He hasn't talked to him for 4 weeks, Tom.
Wayne, the whenever these kind of things happen, there's all these folks who come out of the wall, out of the woodwork, and say, you know, this was the government, this is the Tuskegee experiment on steroids, this is, you know, and our government has done this to people in the past, and many governments have. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. I mean, Ebola has been around for a long time. It lives in fruit bats. And the bats,
right.
The bats live in the caves, and as you have climate change, as you have desertification and things happening across basically the central part of Africa, which is where this is going on, crops are failing, the economies are collapsing, and so people are hacking their way back deeper into the bush and into the jungle looking for food, and they're starting to, you know, eat bush meat, things like bats that they wouldn't have eaten before.
Oh. True.
And that brings these Ebola reservoirs out. And if you look at every Ebola outbreak going all the way back to the 70s, every time it was either war that was pushing refugees into areas that were not inhabited by anything other than bats, or it was a drought or famine. And that makes a whole lot more sense to me than the U.S. government running a bioweapons lab in Sierra Leone. That seems like one of the least safe places on Earth to run a bioweapons lab. Maybe a lab that collects local hemorrhagic fever samples. That makes perfect sense. I mean, you've got Ebola, you've got Marburg, you've got, you know, there's a half a dozen different hemorrhagic fever viruses that float around that part of the world. And having somebody collect those and work with Tulane University to try to come up with vaccines or remedies or whatever, that all makes perfect sense to me. But to flip that around and say this is part of some genocidal plan to kill off people in Africa or, you know, or whatever the variation on that argument may be, that's a real stretch, Wayne. I'm sorry. Just because it's on the Internet doesn't mean it's true.
Okay.
I mean, it's going to take a lot more than that for me.
I just wanted to bring it to the forefront.
Sure. Well, you did. I mean, you did. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. Thanks a lot, Wayne. Thanks for the call. Patricia in Casco, Michigan. Hey, Patricia.
Hi. I just got an interesting question. You've probably seen on Facebook about all those people going for the Wisconsin militia where they want to track and keep track of and follow Democratic voters. Okay. What would be a good thing that you could advise those people and anybody else this happens to do about it, if that happens to you?
Open carry? I really don't know, Patricia. I these voter suppression efforts, this is the way that the Republican Party has basically, or let me rephrase that. This is the way that the party that represents the rich and the powerful, the party that represents the power brokers in this country, at the expense of the working people, and for the last half of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century, that was the Democratic Party. Now it's the Republican Party. And in the early parts of the 19th century, during, you know, the Democratic Party was defending slavery, the Republican Party was opposed to it. So, you know, it kind of goes back and forth. But right now it's the Republican Party that is defending the rich, the well-bred and the well-born, is what Thomas Jefferson called them. Because of that, the only way they can win an election is if they suppress the vote. Chief Justice Rehnquist, who is now passed along, but the way he got to be Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court was by doing good work for Republicans, the main good work that he started out doing back in the mid-60s. He was a very tall guy, like 6'2", tall, large, imposing guy, white guy, and he lived in Arizona. He would go to the polling places where there were high percentages of Hispanics and Native Americans, and he would stand there in the line and challenge people's credentials, challenge their right to vote, person after person after person. And it was so intimidating and so threatening. A lot of people just, you know, left the line because they didn't want to have to deal with this guy. And it was voter suppression. Republicans have been doing voter suppression forever. And this let's hassle the voters thing is just more voter suppression. They had, you know, a bunch of white lawyers going into black districts in Ohio back in 2004 and 2008. And that was when there was one precinct, virtually 100% black precinct, where there was going to be a bunch of these white trolls who were coming in to try to pull a William Rehnquist And these three young African-American men, one of them with a baton, showed up and said, "We're the new Black Panther Party. We're going to prevent, you know, harassment of the voters." And, of course, Fox News took that. And they're still, you know, years later, they're still hysterical about it. It's just that's what Republicans do, Patricia. This thing in Wisconsin is truly mind-boggling. In fact, we're going to have a debate with Kevin Jackson in the next hour about it. That, you know, 300,000 people just basically got kicked off the voting rolls by one of these ALEC proposed bills for voter suppression. It's amazing. Do you have an idea, Patricia?
You know, I wish I was a lawyer, because, or you should ask Mike Papp, because that would be awesome. Is there a legal solution to these guys?
I don't think so. I think that as long as they're not on the property of the voting place itself, that probably you get back to the rules about the abortion clinics, you know, how close you can get and how much you can harass them before it's considered harassment. So I doubt there's any way to stop them. And as long as there are right-wingers who will pay for people to do this stuff, there's always going to be people doing this. Patricia, thanks for the call. We're also going to have Brad Friedman on later today, I believe. Not on my one sheet, but I think Louise told me that yeah, we're, okay, great, at 2:20. We're going to have Brad Friedman on. He's going to be talking about how telling the truth about voting groups, anti-voting groups, can be bad for your economic health. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And back with your calls right after this. It's 15 minutes before the end. And welcome back. Mike, watching Free Speech TV in Bloomington, Indiana, on your local cable system. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I was going to talk about ISIS, but problem in the crisis in Africa. I've researched three treatments for it that might turn Ebola into at least a more recoverable illness, you know, reduce mortality. Mm-hmm. Because I was looking at a paper just came out in JAMA, two papers, where the transmission rate is hovering around 1.4. So every person who gets Ebola transmits it to 1.4 person, right, which eventually becomes exponential.
Right.
Yeah, the only problem with treatments is, looking up alternative treatments, is if it doesn't come from a drug company or it doesn't come from, you know, from something that's been done or something that can make a lot of money, it just doesn't seem to get looked at by most doctors.
Yeah,
they're only used to the drug company representatives come in and educating them. They don't have time to go study the journal research themselves, no matter how good it is, for things that aren't, you know, patented.
No, I understand. And did you see that piece? It was a couple of months ago maybe not even that long ago, in one of the science journals about using statins for Ebola.
Yeah, well, statins don't really have any benefit. For the cholesterol has been studied. It doesn't really benefit lowering cholesterol in that way. Raising good cholesterol helps.
No, I'm talking about for Ebola, that they were saying that because of the statin drug, because of the way that the statin drugs alter the ability of membranes to transmit fluids, and which is how they work. The problem with Ebola is that our membranes all go nuts. You know, that's why they're called hemorrhagic fevers. You bleed through.
The cytokine overreaction. Yeah.
Yeah. You bleed through capillary tissue that's normally only semi-permeable. It becomes fully permeable, and the statin drugs shift it back into a semi-permeable state. And, you know, it made perfect sense to me. I'm guessing it was written by somebody, you know, some guy working for one of the companies that makes statin drugs, you know. But it's
you
like,
know, if it works, who cares if it works?
No, I agree. And he got it out there. So if it does work, I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that there's some people right now who are on statin drugs and they're carefully watching them to see what goes on. But
statins are also anti-inflammatories, which means that they may help suppress the cytokine. That's why I studied astaxanthin, which is comes from an algae. It makes flamingos pink and salmon pink. But it also, there's 100 studies showing that it suppresses the cytokine inflammation response that right. is the overreaction that causes death.
This is the stuff that's in krill too, right, Mike?
Exactly. That's why, and see, the reason why people think it's so good in salmon is the salmon tastes much better when they have the astaxanthin because the astaxanthin preserves it so much better.
Right.
The other two are liposomal ascorbate and cholecalciferol, like vitamin D.
Right.
But we're talking high levels. Vitamin D is both an antiviral and an anti-cytokine. And right. it's 600,000 IU, which is what some Indian researchers gave to school children safely. It might provide enough antiviral and anti-cytokine to slow down the virus.
Yeah, we're learning increasingly that vitamin D, or at least D3, is the new vitamin C. It's the new, this will cure anything. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you. And Wanda in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you wanted to talk about Ebola?
Hello?
Hey, Wanda.
Hi. Yeah, I did. The information I'm going to give, which will be brief, I got from Lori Garrett's prize-winning book, The Coming Plague, and David Quammen, who wrote Spillover, Animal Infections in the Next Pandemic. Mm-hmm. And there are two kinds of viruses, RNA and DNA. And the quote, the different attributes of these account for one of the most crucial differences among viruses, the rate of mutation. RNA mutates profligately. Most mutations are harmful. In The Coming Plague, Lori Garrett tells about this and quotes Jim and Ellen Strauss, who concluded that over the millennia, RNA viruses had mutated more rapidly than DNA viruses, a million times more rapidly. And RNA viruses will continue to evolve rapidly. That's a quote. And Spillover is saying more or less the same thing. The viruses evolve quicker than perhaps any other class of organism on Earth. And unfortunately, the Ebola virus is an RNA virus. Well, we have been told, of course, and we don't know any different to this point, I guess, that we can only contract Ebola by being in contact with fluids from the infected person. However, I would assume that if this RNA virus, which Ebola is, can replicate and mutate and so forth to that extent, we wouldn't probably know for quite some time if it did become airborne.
Well, the other big problem is that AIDS is also an RNA-based virus, and AIDS can't exist in the presence of air. It's a non-aerobic virus. But apparently Ebola can live for 2 or 3 days in the presence of air. So if a person who is infected opens a door and handles the doorknob, that doorknob now is a site of transmission for at least hours or days. They're still trying to figure out how long that period is, which makes this a much more tricky virus than even AIDS, frankly.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Speaking of tricky things and how long it takes to discover things, in one of the books it mentioned that the virus responsible for one pandemic wasn't discovered until 2005, and that was the big pandemic of 1918-1919.
Right.
No one knew what was causing it, so I hope we find out before
that length
of time has
H5N9 flu virus or something like that. Yeah, it was one of the flu viruses.
And we didn't know what flu virus it was until 2005.
Right, we hadn't sequenced the genome, and now they've found old bodies, and they've actually recovered the original virus itself. And you've got another group that has rebuilt the virus using genetic engineering. That's, there's a lot of very strange and scary stuff. Wanda, thank you for the call. Tina in Madison, you wanted to talk about the Wisconsin militia?
I just wanted to respond to what Patricia had called about earlier.
Right.
She was talking about the Wisconsin militia thing. Are you familiar with that?
Not so much.
It's just some group that's on Facebook that's basically talking about how they're going to go to the polls or stand outside of the polls or something like that and watch the people that go in and be intimidating. I don't know. It's all very silly, in my opinion. And I don't think that people should put too much, you know, credibility into it.
No, I don't disagree. On the other hand, three black guys in one polling place in one entire election cycle for 15 minutes, and Fox News has been hysterical about it for 5 years, right? The new Black Panthers. If a half a dozen white guys show up with guns at a polling place in a largely minority district in Wisconsin, Wisconsin militia shows up, somehow I doubt Fox News is going to be hysterical about it for the next 5 years. And what this does is I think it demonstrates the hypocrisy of our media. So anyhow, Tina, thank you for the call. It's a good point. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, thanks for listening to KPFK.
Yes, Professor, I called the United Kingdom this morning. I called the Ecuadorian embassy to speak with Julian Assange. I'm not going to tell you if I spoke with him or if I didn't speak with him. But I want to ask you this question. Would an American be charged with some kind of conspiracy, this grand jury thing is still hanging over his head, if we were to arrange him leaving the embassy and flying to Cuba, Havana? Would the American look forward to any charges?
I don't know. What I do know is that as long as he's on the grounds of the embassy or in the embassy, he's not actually on UK property. He is on property he's on Ecuadorian property. And the minute that he steps off that property, he's now he has effectively, you know, gone through passport control, and now he's in the United Kingdom, and the laws and rules are completely different in the United Kingdom than they are in Ecuador, and embassy property is legally the property of that foreign country as if it was that country, and it's governed by the laws of that country by and large. So, Assange is not feeling well. He's been apparently not had a lot of access to sunlight. He's apparently also lonely. All these things make perfect sense, and he's talking about, I'm going to get out of this embassy, and if he does, he's going to, in all probability, get nailed and, get arrested and get extradited. They'll extradite him first to Sweden, and then the Swedes, once they have him, they'll say, well, you know, these rape charges, they don't matter so much because we just extradited him to America.
I see the problem already without having to mention it. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Morris. Thanks for the call. Tom in Tucson. Hey, Tom. Quick one.
Yes, the job of the new attorney general should be to protect Obama, especially from Tea Party, and to pave the way for the safe return of Snowden.
The safe return of what?
Snowden.
Edward Snowden. Thank you. Yeah, Tom, that sounds like a good agenda. I would like to thank you for the call. I would like him to see, as the chief law enforcement official of the United States, to seriously look into the crimes that are being committed both in our healthcare industry and in our banking industry, and maybe throw some of these bums in jail. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. As I mentioned in the last hour, former Chief Justice Rehnquist on the U.S. Supreme Court made his name in Republican politics rather famously. He was quite proud of it. Back in the 60s, he's a very tall, white guy. He was 6'2", 6'3", quite an imposing figure. And he would, at election time, he lived in Phoenix, he would go to polling places where large numbers of Native Americans, Hispanics, or African Americans were voting, and stand in the line at the door, at the front door, and as a lawyer, a Republican lawyer, challenge every single person's right to vote. And in many cases, in loud, threatening, and intimidating ways. He was quite famous for this, and it really helped him rise through the ranks of the Republican Party. About that time, Paul Weyrich was getting active in Republican politics. By 1980, he was running the Reagan campaign, and he had just co-founded, along with John Kasich, the governor of Ohio right now, he had co-founded in the late 70s a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. And within the year after he had co-founded ALEC, and while he was helping to run the Reagan campaign, Paul Weyrich had this to say to a group of Republican Christian activists, Republicans in a church in Dallas, Texas, who were getting it ready to go out and work on, quote, poll work, basically doing what Rehnquist had been doing. Here's Paul Weyrich, the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, co-founder of ALEC.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And now we have the situation in Wisconsin where a federal judge has said, this ALEC law, Paul Weyrich's organization, this ALEC law that the Wisconsin legislature passed, requiring people to have certain types of ID, student ID doesn't count, certain types of ID to vote, is legal. You can do it. It's going to require 300,000 people to get this ID. That's 6,000 people a day between now and November 4th. And in 48 of the state's 72 counties, the DMV is only open 2 days a week, and those exclusively on weekdays. So people who are poor enough that they don't own a car, thus don't have a driver's license, people who are elderly, people who are disabled, and students who have not yet reached the point where they have enough money to own a car. In fact, they're probably broke because of their student debt. Don't have this ID and will not be able to vote. 300,000 people, Scott Walker, in the spirit of Paul Weyrich, has knocked off the voting rolls of Wisconsin. Kevin Jackson is with us. He's the executive director of The Black Sphere, columnist and syndicated radio host. The Black Sphere, SPHERE.net is the website. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Good to have you. How can you defend this?
I love your setup, man. It has got about as much spin on it.
It is absolutely factual.
No, factual notwithstanding, what you're essentially going over, or I should say omitting, is the idea that I need to know who you are. All the other stuff is meaningless. It would be like me going into your bank and saying, I'm Tom Hartman, and I want to make a withdrawal of all the money in Tom Hartman's account, and them saying to me, well, no problem, and not asking me for ID.
Well, you know, Kevin, actually, you might be able to go into my bank and get something if you had my signature. The ability to sign supersedes. I mean, it's always been considered in American politics as a stronger form of identification. It's harder to fake somebody's signature than to fake their ID.
You know it. That's absolute nonsense. I can't. When they ask me for my ID, for example, when I go to do anything that through Obamacare or whatever, I guarantee you I'm going to have to match up who I am with my license or something. You can't move around this country without valid ID. So let's say that
you
everything
can easily move around this country without valid ID.
No,
and besides that, most people who are disabled or who are elderly are not moving around this country.
That's absolute ridiculous. Everything that you just said there is patently false.
According to the Republican Party in Wisconsin, there's 300,000 people in Wisconsin who won't be eligible to vote in this election, and virtually all of them are either poor, black, Hispanic, elderly, or young.
There you go again. Everybody that you think you need to help. Let me tell you something. If somebody's
everybody that the Republicans don't want to vote, yes.
So, Tom, let me ask you this. What you're telling me then is the ability to get on a plane makes you is inherently dis, against the people that you just named.
Kevin,
what I'm defending is something very simple. The right to vote is supposedly our number one precious thing as a citizen. What you're saying is anybody who wants to challenge that and make sure that somebody is validly voting in an election is somehow racist or against everybody. I think that's patently ridiculous.
So let me get this straight. I just want to understand this.
Sure.
We know that we have had over the last 14 years 31 cases of in-person voter fraud out of a billion votes cast. Republican attorneys general will tell you this. 31 cases in 13 years. And so it's a non-problem. And you want big government to spend hundreds of millions of dollars all across the United States creating an elaborate ID scheme, which is absolutely unnecessary, simply to inflate the size of government. And by the way, as a side effect, it's going to knock 300,000 people off the voting rolls in Wisconsin, 400,000 people off the voting rolls in South Carolina, 270,000 people off the voting rolls in Georgia. But, hey, that's the price you pay to prevent 31 people from illegally voting over a 13-year period.
Is that it? 31 people are the only people that it's right. Yeah. Well, I would suggest you get researchers to do a little bit better job, because if you Google voter fraud and voter valid ID and these measures that are preventing people that are actually allowing illegals to vote, you're going to have a very different idea around that.
Kevin.
I want to make one other point.
Wait a second. You just invoked the whole, oh my God, the Mexicans are going to come over here and vote. It's one of the most racist arguments that these Republicans make. And B, what person who is in the United States without documentation illegally and takes a chance literally every day they get on a bus or go someplace, taking a chance with their life, is going to walk into a voting booth, is going to stand in a place where they know that they're going to be challenged, their name
really
has to be on the list, they have to have a signature that matches. It's a fantasy, Kevin. You have bought this fantasy from these rich white guys.
Tom, you should at least let them talk. The fantasy is this. The fantasy is every argument that you're waging, I would ask it very simply to you. If you believe that the right to vote is the most precious thing of a citizen, why are you so hell-bent on keeping people from validating that people are legitimately able to vote?
Kevin, if you believe that the right to vote is so important, why are you hell-bent on denying people the right to vote?
I'm not.
How can you support 300,000 people being thrown off the voting rolls in Wisconsin?
But that's absolutely nonsense, because you know what? Here's the thing what happens with you guys. You make a statement about who can or can't do something, and you believe that the people will just accept it. I'm not going to accept it, Tom. As I've said to you before on your program, I'm a black person. I grew up in poverty. I've managed to figure out how to get a valid ID. I know how to get valid ID. You want me to believe that I'm too stupid to get a valid ID, and everybody else you named, Mexicans,
Kevin, you know, this argument is the most patronizing, racist thing. I'm astounded that you would even say that, to suggest that I'm suggesting that you're stupid somehow.
Oh, you are. That's exactly what you're doing.
No, I'm suggesting that you're a shill.
No, what you don't believe is that black people who are handicapped don't understand, hey, can I call my cousin to go take me down to get an ID? As I said to you before, if it takes me getting an ID to get to your money at your bank account, or to get on a plane, or to get a reasonable ticket, or to do the things that I need, I can't even pick up my tickets from Will Call without a valid ID, and you think I'm too stupid to get one.
Kevin, I'll leave you with the last word. Kevin, I'm trusting our listeners and viewers to have enough common sense to sort this argument out. Kevin Jackson, you can read his stuff over at theblacksphere.net. Thanks, Kevin. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls right after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Oh, actually, Brad Friedman's going to be with us in a bit. Oh, it's the next hour? 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Catherine, watching Free Speech TV in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine.
Hi. I have some stuff on the voter ID, and I have some virus geek stuff you really need to know and follow up on.
Okay,
let's talk about living in Wisconsin. It's not a matter of being too stupid to get. It's a matter of being too poor to afford to leave work for one or two days. It was systematically done, the closing of those and the reducing of the hours of the motor vehicles department in order to get to this point.
Right.
The second thing they did was they outsourced the making of the driver's license. They go privatization to California to get done.
Hmm.
That means even as many people as could go through to get a license or to get an ID in a day will not get them that day. So you're reducing the number of people that are going to be able to get it in time
right.
on top of that.
So you have to wait for it to arrive in the mail.
Yeah, 1 to 2 weeks.
Wow.
And imagine when they start flooding in there. Are they going to prioritize it? No, they're not.
Right, right. So, yeah, this is the only way Republicans can win elections. They
right.
can't win on the issues, so they're going to win on suppressing the vote.
Yeah. Now, getting to the viruses, we have a researcher here. I cannot pronounce his name. It's Y-O-S-H-I-R-O-K-A-W-A-O-K-U. And he has copied the Spanish flu and made it be able to spread quicker. He has, he's working on Ebola. He was working on H1N1 that it was so controversial that they had to stop. The Pasteur Institute in France says it's madness and folly what they're doing here. Lord May in the United Kingdom says what they are doing is absolutely crazy, grossly ambitious people.
Is this, wait a second, Catherine, who is this a private agency that's doing this to try to come up with vaccines and things or what?
This is through UW Research. It's in a little lab that's supposed to have high security clearance that I go past all the time on the bus on the west side of Madison.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yes, it's absolutely horrible. It says they've gotten a flu strain that's capable of evading the immune system.
Hmm.
The virologist Simon Wayne Hosbin says if society and intelligent people knew what was going on, they'd say, what the F are you doing? And that's exactly what I said when I found out about it. I'd love for you to do some research on it and talk about it. This is just insane.
Yeah,
what
this
here.
Is pretty consequential. Put a link over on TomHartmann.com on my daily blog.
I can't because I can't get Flash, but I can send the producer some information.
Okay,
to
cool.
Go
That's part. Fine. That's great. Catherine, thank you so much for
Such fun living in Wisconsin.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, is there, in the media there in Wisconsin, is it being openly discussed that this is a voting suppression effort?
Same old. You know, like you've got some of the alternatives saying some things. I don't read, the Journal Centennial just for those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, when you've packed the court and the court does it within not enough time for people to get. Oh, and they're not charging for the ID. That's another thing that they'll say. But like I said, it's just not being seen as difficult as it is. We had a couple of people who did a lot of work on election protection.
Mm-hmm.
And they were turned down by the Justice Department to look at what was going on here.
Wow.
And the Government Accountability Board would not move on what they did. And they gave up their jobs and they spent over 2.5 years doing things.
Wow. I'm not surprised. Catherine, thank you. Thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Amazing. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. You wanted to talk about Wisconsin voter suppression, Margie?
Yeah, and a friend of mine, very good friend of mine, is a poll worker, has been for many years in Madison. Four quick points. First of all, they closed 10 DMV offices, all of them in minority districts right after the law was passed. Number two, with the IDs being mailed, people are not going to be able to get them. Also, how does a homeless person get ID if it's mailed to them and they're homeless?
Right.
So no homeless people will be able to vote. It's going to be a much higher number than 300,000 people. That's they're just looking at who doesn't have the ID. What about people who have moved or who have had their name changes? This is how they get women to not be able to vote. Women, when they get married, frequently change their last name. Also, that happens when they get divorced. If they haven't updated their ID, they're not going to be able to
vote. Or their voter registration.
And
yeah.
Exactly. And the final thing is, absentee ballots were already mailed. They're already being sent back. It's a mess.
Wow. Wow. This, okay.
And this is it. You know, to do this is, there's going to be way more than 300,000 people.
Yeah. I think we're looking at the last gasp of the Republican Party. Margie, thank you for the call. Bob in Madison, Wisconsin. Speaking of Wisconsin, you wanted to speak to my question to an earlier listener asking, you know, in Wisconsin, is this being reported as voter suppression or as some kind of noble effort by the part of Scott Walker to make sure that everything's clean and up on the up and up?
No, Tom, actually, this is entirely about voter suppression. Scott Walker has done such a poor job and has such a deplorable record here in the state of Wisconsin that there's absolutely, with the ideas that he has, all Alec, there's no way he could win without pulling this stunt. And he's manipulated the courts. He's used his state attorney general to facilitate that particular aspect of it. We're in a real hurt here in Wisconsin. We've got some, myself and my girlfriend, very, very ready and willing to lead the state should he get reelected, because we see what his agenda is here on forward. It's all Alec-funded, based, and, you know, he's planning on right to work. But, yeah, as far as the suppression aspect of it, the timing of the whole thing, you know, I mean, I can't even believe that a district court would allow the kind of thing to allow to continue. I'm perfectly fine with voter registration and getting people IDs. I think it's something that everyone should be entitled to, and they can decide at that particular point whether they want to continue on and do the voting. But there simply is not enough time in the state of Wisconsin to facilitate that, and I think it's totally it's going to be disastrous.
Yeah. 6,000 IDs a day from between now and November 4th will have to be issued just in the state of Wisconsin. And a third of the DMV offices now, a bunch of them have been closed, and a third of them are only open 2 days a week, and those are weekdays. And this is mind-boggling. Bob, thank you for the call. Nick in San Diego, California, you wanted to disagree with somebody, with our guest on voter ID?
Well, the guy that you had on, again, like so many of these other people, and I don't want to accuse you of drinking the Kool-Aid, but they canard. Well, what's wrong with saying why is it a problem identifying people who come to vote? I think anyone would agree that you ought to be able to identify yourself when you come to vote. That's not an issue. The issue is the mechanics. Like so many things, the devil's in the details, and you've kind of gotten into this since the guy was on the phone with you. But I wish that you and other people, when you're talking to these people, would bring these points up about the fact that not the issue of whether or not you can identify yourself, it's the mechanics. Mm-hmm. Why are the DMVs closing 3 days for 5 hours a day? Why are the DMVs closing in Democratic districts? Why is it that, yeah, they say that these IDs that they'll give you are free, but you have to pay $150 to get copies of your birth certificate, and on and on and on? Why are there fewer voting machines in Democratic districts? You know, all these things that make it difficult for people to vote. It's not just a matter of saying, what's wrong with identifying yourself?
Right. And back before the Supreme Court blew up the Voting Rights Act, you could argue that these are clear violations of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, as I recall. But in fact, you know, now it's like, okay, you know, Scott Walker, you want to keep minorities from voting, you want to keep students from voting, you want to keep elderly people from voting, you want to keep disabled people from voting, go for it. This is basically what this federal court has said.
Well, again, like I say, when the next time you have one of these guys on, why don't you start out by saying, okay, fine. Everybody ought to be able to identify themselves when they come to vote. I agree with you. Now, let's talk about the mechanics.
Right. How are we going to do this? Okay, Nick, thanks a lot for the call. I, you know, the reality is that the first time you register to vote, you identify yourself. I always have. And you sign the card. And your signature in the future is enough to vote with, right? So we've all been through this process, at least anybody who's a registered voter. And then your signature is how you identify yourself. But no, they want to say, oh, you got to have this, that, and the other thing. It's voter suppression.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's, as I said, it's the only way Republicans can win an election because, you know, their agenda is totally about the Koch brothers and the billionaire, period. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And that's amazing. It's amazing. Eric Holder is on his way out, and in an interview with Yahoo News, he said about pot, about marijuana, he said, quote, I think it's certainly a question that we need to ask ourselves whether or not marijuana is as serious a drug as is heroin. He said, the question on whether or not they should be in the same category is something that I think we need to ask ourselves and use science as the basis for making that determination. So, I mean, you know, we opened the show with Dr. Papantonio essentially saying that he wasn't all that happy with Eric Holder. Let's characterize it that way. But at least with this, you know, with regard to this, and I'm not sure that any other AG could have done it any differently, because when Washington State and Colorado both voted to legalize marijuana and tax it as a recreational drug, the federal government had the power. He had the full legal authority to go into both those states and arrest everybody who had any pot at all. And instead, he said, you know, we're not going to do that. We're going to let the states work this out. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. That's a good first step. Don, in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, you wanted to talk about voter ID?
Yeah, Tom. We're lucky to have you.
Thank you.
One thing that your guest said about how you can't survive without an ID, I can't remember the last time I used mine. I'm 60 years old, and I think the only time I pulled my ID out in the last 20 years was to get it renewed.
The only time that I have used any ID, I'm trying to think. I don't need to use it at the bank because I do all my banking either by mail on the app or at the ATM machines. And, you know, I've just got a card for that. I guess getting on an airplane, and I've got one of those global, whatever they call it, you know, the go through the short line thing, you pay $100 and you get to do a security check and they take your fingerprints. And I did that whole song and dance because I travel a lot. And, you know, it's through the TSA. So I'm not even using my regular ID. When you know, living here in D.C., I went down just before my birthday in May and got my driver's license renewed because it was expiring. And I'm not sure why, because I don't own a car. You know, it's just it'll be a hell of a lot easier than you know, when the day comes that we move out of Washington D.C. and who knows when that'll be. But, you know, if that day comes, then I will buy a car. And at that time, I'm going to have a driver's license, and I don't want to have to go through taking a test again. So, you know, keep the license current. It's easier than taking the test. But that's about it.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, it's a very thought-provoking call because I haven't, other than getting on an airplane, I haven't used an ID to, you know, I pick up pharmaceuticals for Louise and I. They've never asked for ID.
And the people who would be disenfranchised by these voter ID laws, they don't fly in an airplane.
Yeah.
So they would have no need for one.
Right.
But one thing I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if this has ever been, has it been tried before, or maybe you could tell me, but since the Supreme Court has ruled that spending money is speech, certainly they would think the casting of vote is speech. And
yeah,
people who are fighting these voter ID laws, I wonder if they bring that up as an issue that, well, you're keeping me from my First Amendment right to free speech.
Oh, that's an excellent point. What is a more fundamental form of political speech than casting a vote? Yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely brilliant, Don. And, you know, the Supreme Court is not going
to
rule that in all probability. Pardon?
It's nice talking to you.
Good talking to you, Don. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Robert in Gray Court, South Carolina. Hey, Robert.
Yes, I got a couple of questions. One, are the Iraqis smarter than we are? When they voted, whenever we went through and took out their government, then they elected another government. The individual would vote, stick his finger in the ink, and go on about his business.
Right.
We could do that just as well and save any question about voter fraud.
Yeah, we could. And they were using the same old system that we did, that when I was 7 years old, I used to stand beside my mom as she sat at the tables at the in our local elementary school, and the people came in to vote, and she would check their name off the list and have them sign a paper or have them sign the book and make sure that their signature was the same as the one on the card, and then let them go vote. And in most cases, she knew them. You know, it's somebody who lived in our neighborhood. They lived within a few blocks of our house, and she always said, "Hello, John. Hello, Patsy. You know, here, go ahead and vote." I mean, she'd have them sign in. They still had to do it, but that's, you know, in Iraq, it's if somebody showed up speaking bad Arabic or speaking Arabic in a way that wasn't the local dialect or something, you might raise some eyebrows. But voting, in-person voting fraud is not a problem in the United States. Therefore, it doesn't need a solution. But these guys want big government to spend hundreds of millions of dollars deciding who can vote and who can't, and making it harder for people who are poor, disabled, young, or old, or people of color to vote. And it's just wrong. Robert, thank you for the call. Scott in Chicago. Hey, Scott, you are from Wisconsin?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that you do have to show your ID in Wisconsin to register to vote.
As you do in most states.
And your address changes, once again, you have to show your ID.
Right.
And then my second point is, whenever you argue with anybody in regards to voting ID with Republicans, replace vote with guns. And they don't even know what to say.
Right.
And if money is speech, how come I earn a living, an hourly wage, get taxed at 32% on my speech, but if my money is sitting in the stock market, I get taxed at 15% on my speech?
Right. Right. Which just shows the absurdity of money not being speech. And your point about, it would have been interesting to ask our conservative talk show host guest, how do you feel about, showing ID to buy a gun? That's excellent point. Scott, thank you for that. Antoine in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to apologize for that host that you had. He was just shy of calling you a racist. And I don't believe that at all about you. I enjoy your show. But my question that I wish you would have asked him, why aren't they doing anything about voter fraud in Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota? Why is it always the big states where minorities are that is a problem?
Good point.
And my second comment is, I'm not really angry at Republicans for what they do now. Democrats and liberals, they just don't get out and vote. And you can't blame people for taking things from you if you don't participate.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really
That's
important
my comment.
Yeah, it's a really important point, Antoine. And I, you know, we have to every one of us has to do everything we can to get people out to vote. Thank you very much for the call, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, I just want to make a quick comment about Wisconsin. It's incredibly scary, and I think that most of the problems in Wisconsin is that they want to, change it from a purple state to a red state. I mean, it's right. The Koch brothers are so involved in their politics that they are actually telling people just absolute ridiculous things who live way far away from Madison, Milwaukee, and the centers of Democratic influence, and so they can sway the state in that direction, and they want to do the same here. But what I wanted to call about was, Eric Holder was involved in prosecuting the Humanitarian Law Project, and he won against the Supreme Court. The case was won in the Supreme Court. It was heard in the Supreme Court, and as a result of that, people, both their free speech and their, the Fourth Amendment protection against search and seizure was abridged, and that happened here. And it was really scary for me because I've given to some of these organizations that these people were involved with, and what it had to do with was that, if you don't have to actually give material support to terrorists, you can, just be talking to them or, you know, you can be talking to a group that is, you know, possibly considered having links to terrorism, and that is considered supporting terrorism. And there were people in this community, ordinary people, like Mike Papantonio said, you know, for ordinary people, this is really kind of scary, because people who just, you know, work ordinary jobs that are also activists were targeted. And it's a very...
tell me, John, we just have a minute to the break, but very quickly, can you tell me what the Humanitarian Law Project was?
Well, the Humanitarian Law Project, I think it was through George Washington University. And, you know, in this particular case, they were litigating a point in the Patriot Act. And that, you know, there was a case brought up, and, you know, that was the issue, was that if you talk to terrorists, or if you talk to organizations that may have given, you know, there are some, you know, some of these organizations both do humanitarian things, and also, you know, they have been involved, say, like in Palestine or in Colombia or whatever. And, I mean, they went back 10 years on the most flimsiest kinds of excuses and literally broke in without search and, you know, without a warrant, broke into people's homes. And they dumped their personal belongings all over the place as they kept them there for like 12 hours as they searched.
Wow.
I mean, that would be...
And this was upheld by the courts?
It was upheld by the court, by the Supreme Court.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm gonna have to track that one down. John, thank you for the information. Thanks for calling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And make sure that you are registered to vote, and everyone you know is registered to vote. Time is running out here. We're just more or less 6 weeks out. And welcome back. Oh, this is interesting. The FBI is reporting, or at least the CNN is reporting, that the FBI believes that they know who was that British guy who cut off James Foley's head. This should be interesting. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, you want to talk about ISIS in Saudi Arabia? Corky? Hello? No, Corky. Okay, let's try PETA in Goshen, New Hampshire. PETA, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for watching Free Speech TV.
Okay. Yes, I am. A question. You know, I watch the German news, the French news, the American news, the British news, and obviously everything's revolving at the moment around getting active support for this fight against ISIS. And one name that seems to be blaringly absent is Israel. And I would have thought that that would be the country in that region that is the most threatened. I understand why some of the Arab countries don't want to join up, because they're afraid of their own population. But Israel is an extremely unified country, and I just wonder why we're not hearing about their participation in this fight.
I would guess, and most of the Arab, I mean, you now have Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, a number of the Sunni countries in the region, Jordan, whose planes are flying in these bombing raids. So this, you know, this really... President Obama has actually brought together the Sunni Arabs in a way that has not been done before, to the best of my knowledge. The big problem that the United States has, and I'm going to get to Israel, but I think we need to establish this. The big problem that we have in that region, and the reason why Obama does not want to have boots on the ground and doesn't want to be the United States to be perceived as, you know, the ones who are running the show, as it were, is that people in the region tend to think of us as those, you know, as a different... Essentially, a different race, a different religion, a different nationality, a different, you know, just basically, we are completely different. We are, you know, and it heightens this clash of civilizations perception that increases the annoyance or the hatred for the United States or the West. And I would say that the extent to which the more paranoid faction of Muslims in the Middle East don't like a, quote, Christian United States, they don't like a Jewish Israel even more. And so
exactly.
Israel would, you know, if I was Obama, I would not want Israel involved in this. It would be like pouring gasoline on a fire.
No, I completely understand that. But, I mean, it seems like we, Israel is probably very smart unless they don't actively participate in anything unless they are threatened. They seem to be more of a defensive nation, which I think is a smart policy. But I was just thinking, since sooner or later they are going to be threatened, without doubt, because they're probably hated more than we are, why they don't participate at the moment.
Yeah, I think their hands are quite full with the settlement issue, with the Gaza Strip issue, you know, basically with the Palestinians. And
I think that IS is going to get into those areas.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know what the Sunni-Shia split is on the West Bank or in Gaza. That would be an interesting thing to learn about. One of the things I don't know right off the top of my head. Peter, thanks very much for the call. Thoughtful. A lot to consider. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones is up next. Your media support group for we, the people of the United States, of the planet Earth. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, Victoria Jones, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
It's always nice to see you. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, President Obama and U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder will announce today that Holder is going to leave his post at the Justice Department once a successor is confirmed.
Okay.
So that could be a while, or it could be very quick. It all depends. I'm quite sure that President Obama would like to see somebody confirmed quickly, particularly if the Democrats are in danger of losing the Senate, which they are. But the confirmation process could be drawn out. If you have to have a hearing, you have to have meet and greet. And apparently they have known for a month now that Holder is ready to go.
Yeah, it was Labor Day that he sat
Labor Day
Obama weekend. Down and said.
Yeah. Right. And they haven't settled on anybody. Now, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, whose name was being floated about today, is in Washington for meetings. And he said before he even left Massachusetts that he is not up for the job. And, in fact, he said as he got out of a car in D.C. today, no.
Yeah. So, well, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
There are other names, including Solicitor General Verrilli.
Right.
The Attorney General of California and the prosecutor in Manhattan South, Preet Bharara, who has been very successful in some very tough terrorism prosecution.
The guy I would love to see is the former AG for the state of New York, who got busted with the socks on.
Oh.
I'm drawing a blank on his name. Eric Schneiderman. No, not Eric Schneiderman. Who is the... Yeah, Spitzer. Elliot Spitzer. Thank you.
Spitzer, yes.
Yeah. He would make a great attorney general. He would take names and kick butt all the way across this country.
He would.
Which is why they took him down. He was doing that in New York.
He was.
In my humble opinion.
He was. And it's just never, ever going to happen.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that movie, Client Number 9?
No.
Oh, you've got to rent that. I'm sure it's on, you know, Amazon or what, in Netflix someplace. Client Number 9 is a documentary about Elliot Spitzer's fall. And in it, you've got this guy, Roger Stone, who was working for this billionaire Wall Street guy that Spitzer was starting to investigate. And Stone committed federal crimes to bring down Elliot Spitzer and brags about it in the documentary. Both of these guys brag about how they brought down this guy by committing federal crimes. It's a mind, but it's frankly, it's scary, because what it says is if a billionaire wants to take you down, you're going down no matter who you are. And but Client Number 9, it's really, really worth watching. If you ever do bring it up, let me know. I would love to get your thoughts on it. So what else is going on in the world?
President Obama today at the United Nations warned world leaders that the international response to the Ebola crisis is not enough. He said, we know from experience that the response to an outbreak of this magnitude needs to be both fast and sustained like a marathon, but run at the pace of a sprint. He said, everyone has to do more. He said, this must be a priority for the world. He talked about how the U.S. is leading and doing our part. He said, everyone can do something. He said, if this epidemic is not stopped, this disease could cause a humanitarian catastrophe across the region and that stopping Ebola is in the interest of the entire world. He sounded not frustrated exactly, but like he really felt the need to get the attention of a number of countries.
Yeah, I understand. And there are countries, I mean, China now, 2 years ago, they put into place a national healthcare system, but it still only covered about two-thirds of the Chinese, which is, you know, more than twice the population of the United States, but it's still not complete and comprehensive. India has a very, very fragile healthcare system. And in fact, they have a real problem with infectious disease there. 1 in 10 people in India right now is infected with tuberculosis. And so, you know, if this disease was to jump out of Africa into some of these high population density areas in Asia, you know, Europe can probably deal with it. But in Asia, in parts of South America, in parts of Central America, in parts of Russia, it could be a real problem in these particularly remote areas where there's not a good, you know, although I guess the population density is low in some of those areas, but not in China. I mean, this could,
right?
You know, this could really, really kick the butt of the world. So,
the Iraqi prime minister said today to reporters that his country's intelligence operation has uncovered a plot for an attack on subway systems in the U.S., believed to be New York and Paris. Now, he said the attacks were imminent. Well, he asked if they were imminent. He said, I'm not sure. Asked if the attacks have been thwarted, he said no. He said that he was receiving accurate reports from Baghdad, that there had been arrests of a few elements. He said that they are not Iraqis. Some of them are French, some of them are Americans, but they are in Iraq. U.S. officials from the National Security Council are basically saying it's news to us. They're not aware of this.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know, whether it's going on and they don't know or whether it's inaccurate, don't know. But that's extremely disturbing.
Yes, yes.
Members of Oregon's congressional delegation, bipartisan, are really criticizing new rules from the United States Forest Service that restricts photography and video in national forests.
Huh.
Now, there's a report that photos and videos would require a $1,500 permit, and lawmakers say these rules are unnecessary and overreaching.
Was this something the lumber companies came up with?
This is what the Forest Service has come up with.
The who has come up with?
The Forest Service.
Oh, I know that, but the Forest Service didn't come up with this out of you know, a complete vacuum. There's some interest group that was pushing this thing, or the Forest Service wouldn't be doing it. Unless what's their rationale?
Well, they say that the rules are a good faith effort to ensure the fullest protection of America's wild places. Senator Ron Wyden says the Forest Service needs to rethink any policy that subjects non-commercial photographs and recordings to a burdensome permitting process for something as simple as taking a picture with a cell phone.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, under these new policies, if you're camping and you take a picture, you know, of your partner in the camp, you've committed a crime. That's amazing.
No,
Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Yeah, thank you, Victoria.
Bye.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Wow.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Chris Murray is on the line with us, senior research scientist with the EcoHealth Alliance, the website ecohealthalliance.org. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Or Dr. Murray, I should say.
That's fine.
Tell me about how climate change is playing a role in the spread of Ebola.
Okay, so with Ebola, it's I think the science is not in yet about how climate change is impacting the risk of Ebola. There are a number of ways that climate change could contribute to future risks of Ebola, and that's because Ebola is a disease that lives in animals, and those animals are subject to environmental conditions and their
it's principally bats, isn't it?
Bats is definitely one of the implicated reservoirs for Ebola virus, but people also get Ebola directly from eating other animals that have been potentially in contact with bats. So, for example, people eating bush meat such as primates or whatever have contracted Ebola that way.
Right.
And so climate change has the capacity to shift the distributions of species and contact patterns with bats, and that's one potential mechanism.
If you look at the global maps that have global climate change superimposed on them, you know, the warming Earth, what you see is that, you know, across the northern central part of Africa, the desert expanding as the planet warms. And I'm just wondering if these countries, Sierra Leone and Guinea and whatnot, that are, you know, that historically have been in an area that is very, very lush, if they're drying out, and if that might be what's driving people farther and farther into remote areas where they're exposing themselves to these viruses. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's definitely possible, and probably one of the other things is the impact on the actual landscape, that, you know, the loss of forests and native systems, and that kind of brings people into greater contact with wildlife that are in the areas. And so as you have these sort of changing contact patterns between animals and humans, as these major landscape level processes are impacting animal distributions and behaviors, that's when you start to see the potential increase in risk from diseases spilling over from wildlife.
What are the other health considerations outside of Ebola that are vulnerable to exacerbation as a consequence of global climate change? You know, what should be on our radar screen? Are we misplacing our priorities?
Well, I think the public health community has started to take climate change much more seriously as an issue. I think there's been a lot of attention on vector-borne diseases in particular, because those vectors themselves are subject to distributional changes under changing climate. So vector-borne diseases have had a lot of focus, but there's also been some attention given to, say, waterborne pathogens, for example, things like Giardia. Also in the food industry, things like Salmonella, they're temperature dependent in terms of their replication, their rate of replication, and so increasing temperatures has the potential to increase risks from a bunch of different types of diseases.
Are there any diseases or parts of the world where we can now, in 2014, say, oh, right here, as a consequence of global climate change, we saw this impact on public health?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difficulty is that a lot of the mechanisms around infectious diseases are all kind of intercorrelated, and so it is quite difficult to pull out a specific signal of climate change for any specific system. That said, there are a lot of very convincing correlational studies that show, for example, changes in distributions under recent climate change. So climate change is something that is already here. The planet's already warmed by something like 0.6 of a degree compared to historical averages. So things are changing, and we are seeing things like the northern extension of tick ranges, the ticks that carry Lyme disease, and things like tick-borne encephalitis in Europe. Those things are actually on the march northwards as a result of climates becoming more suitable for the vector,
right,
in those areas.
One of the things that we saw here in the D.C. area last winter was that across much of the United States, was that as the temperature gradient between the temperature difference between the mid latitudes where most of us live and the temperate latitudes and the Arctic latitudes, the northern latitudes, as that temperature gradient has diminished because the Arctic is warming five or six times faster than the mid latitudes are, as that temperature differential has changed, the strength of the jet stream, with this wall of air that kind of is blocked or held into place by that temperature gradient, it has started just drooling down over the rest of North America, at least east of the Rockies. The Rockies have now become the physical barrier that keeps the jet stream in place to the north, thus blocking its access to California and whatnot. But could it be that the new normal is we're going to have these polar vortexes every winter in the Midwest and the East Coast of the United States? And if so, are we going to see things like black flies moving from Vermont down to D.C.?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, that's a question I can't really answer. I'm not really a climatologist or a meteorologist, but certainly the change, there is going to be a major change in weather patterns. There has already been a change in weather patterns, like you're pointing out, and that definitely has the potential to change the distributions of things like black flies, which I know from a recent camping experience can be quite.
Oh yeah, I lived in Vermont, New Hampshire. Black flies are the scourge, the springtime scourge.
Right. Yeah. So I think that kind of illustrates the general mechanism. If black flies are carrying infectious diseases that can get into people, and the distribution of black flies is changing as a direct result of changing climate patterns, that's the sort of mechanisms that we're talking about in terms of increasing disease risks for people under a different climate.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. What are the what about good old fashioned things like the flu and whatever happened to SARS? I mean, and for that matter, there was this SARS like virus that was coming out of Saudi Arabia that everybody was all very concerned about and suddenly has vanished from the headlines. Apparently camels were the vector on that. I don't even remember the acronym now. Can you bring us up to date on those things?
Yeah, sure. So the one that came out of Saudi Arabia was called MERS, or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. It probably has a bat reservoir, actually, and camels are implicated in also hosting that virus. It's a coronavirus similar to SARS. It killed a few people, and it certainly grabbed the headlines because it showed early on sort of SARS-like properties that really sort of scared the global public.
Is that still going on, and we're just ignoring it because of Ebola, or has it been stopped?
To be honest, I don't know what the latest case numbers on MERS is. I'd actually have to check with somebody that's working on that. But certainly it's dropped out of the public eye, possibly as a result of the enormous Ebola epidemic that's really taken over there.
Right. And SARS, another coronavirus, another virus that's related to the common cold. That just, it came out of bushmeat in China. One of the cats, wasn't it? A serval?
A civet cat, yep.
Civet cat, that's right. And, we nailed it down. We stopped it, apparently. It's gone forever, or it's gone back into the wild reservoir?
Yeah, very likely it's still circulating in wild animal reservoirs. Civets were the kind of the link. Civets were brought into a market situation and then infected other animals in the market that then got sold, and that's how it kind of spread out of the wildlife reservoir and into human populations. It did cause quite a lot of panic because it started killing people, and that was obviously a very alarming thing. But also it had very big impacts on economic kind of processes, so that you had impacts on travel and trade
and people were afraid to fly. I mean, it was an amazing time.
Right, exactly.
Dr. Chris Murray, Senior Research Scientist with the EcoHealth Alliance. Hang on just a second, Dr. Murray.
Sure.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I always steps on you. EcoHealthAlliance.org is the website. Thank you, Dr. Murray.
No problems.
Great talking with you. Thank you very much. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Oneida in Maine, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV channel or satellite system. Hey, Oneida, that was you who I played the clip.
That was me.
who made the contribution and said, I challenge you in Maine and Missouri to go out and vote. And you're also You gave a challenge grant donation to Free Speech TV, so they're going to be matching. You're going to be matching other people's donations.
Correct. I wanted all my friends that I left in Missouri to know that I was doing this.
That's great. That's great. Well, I hope they do. And thank you so much for watching Free Speech TV and for pitching in.
Can I say one more thing, please?
Anything you'd like.
When I talked to you the last time about education, the reason I really called was to say I had just finished all 7 episodes of The Roosevelt, and I thought that episode, that series, should be shown in every school in either 8th or 9th grade, including the men that made America.
Now, I have not yet watched this. Where can you find it?
Which one?
The 7 episodes. Where, I'm assuming you found them online?
The Roosevelt. They were on PBS.
Okay,
for 7 nights in a row.
Oh, okay. So you watched them live on television.
For sale. The DVD is for sale for a whole $120.
Whoa.
And the book is put out by a man named Burns and written by a historian.
Yeah, Ken Burns.
And it is really factual. I always look for hidden bias, and I couldn't find any. It told the good and the bad about both Theodore and Franklin.
Right.
And it devoted a whole lot of time for Eleanor and what she did. And it was amazing.
Right. Did they get the woman who was the Secretary of Labor?
She was in it. She was in it.
Frances Perkins was her name, isn't it?
Yes, she was in it, too.
Because there's the new book out that's a biography of Frances Perkins called The Woman Behind the New Deal, as I recall. And it's a marvelous behind-the-scenes look at the FDR presidency.
That was shown as well as his 2 mistresses, which I didn't even know.
Yeah, yeah. He was with one of them when he died down in Warm Springs.
Well, she was there just before he died, but when Mrs. Roosevelt was on the way to him in Warm Springs, she got the heck out of there. And it was her own daughter, Anna, that told her that I have been arranging their meetings now for years, and she just left. And it was a crucial blow to her, especially after the first mistress was made known.
Yeah, yeah.
It was truly a great series. I'm serious.
Yeah. Well, Louise and I have to watch this, and so I've got to figure out how we can do it now after the fact, whether it's pulling it off the PBS website.
Do you have that Roku or something?
Pardon?
Do you have the Roku or the Hulu?
Yeah, we have a Roku box, and I just have to figure out what channel it's on or where it is. I may have to...
It was on our main channel 10, PBS.
Yeah. Okay, I may have to buy it off Amazon or something like that and watch it, but it sounds like a really remarkable series.
Well, really, Tom, it was well worth watching. It was like your history book.
Oh, great. Okay. Oneida, thanks so much. And thanks so much for making a significant contribution to Free Speech TV and calling people out, asking them to match it or offering to match them. Thank you so much. Great talking with you, Oneida. We'll be back. Past the hour, your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program, and I am so pleased to have our old friend Brad Friedman, editor and publisher of the Brad Blog. Bradblog.com is the website, on the line with us. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Tom. How are you, sir?
I am well. Welcome back.
Good.
Thanks for giving us a shout. Tell me about, you have been threatened by a Republican operative?
Yes, well, you know, just another life in the day of bradblog.com. But in this case, Nathan Spruill from Arizona, this longtime GOP operative with a checkered past. He's run voter registration drives in state after state, election cycle after election cycle, going back at least to George W. Bush in 2004. And every single time, he and his companies are involved in these allegations of voter registration fraud, destroying, shredding Democratic registrations, changing Democratic registrations to Republicans.
Well, you may remember in the 2012 election, the lead up to that election, there was this huge voter registration fraud scandal that was at the heart of the Republican Party. This company that had been secretly hired by the Republicans called Strategic Allied Consulting. Well, this was Nathan Spruill's outfit, and the Republicans, as according to Spruill, had asked him to create this company, but don't put his name on it because he had such a bad reputation.
Hmm.
Well, there were hundreds of fraudulent voter registration forms turned in initially in Florida, in Palm Beach County. Then it spread to a bunch of other counties in Florida, then to a bunch of other states, Colorado, Nevada, Virginia, North Carolina, and so forth. And, of course, I was covering it, as I'm wont to do, at bradblog.com. And one of the things that I found along the way and documented as we went was that, in fact, these guys had this scam for registering only Republican voters. They would set up outside of libraries or, you know, so forth, and they would pretend to be pollsters. And they would ask people, are you voting for, if the election were held today, would you vote for Mitt Romney or Barack Obama? And if they said Mitt Romney, they'd say, great, can we help you register to vote today?
Hmm.
If they said Barack Obama, they'd say, thank you for taking our poll. Have a nice day.
Wow.
So they were, you know, purposely suppressing the
Is that illegal, Brad?
It depends. In different states, there are different rules for this. He has not been prosecuted for it. His companies have gotten away with it. But if you look at the actual state laws, it is anywhere from illegal to dubious to, of course, highly unethical. But Nathan Spruill is very proud of it. He thinks it's just great. And he's told me so in email. Well, as things progressed here, we've just had our fourth arrest in the state of Florida. The guy who initially turned in the fraudulent registrations that kicked this all off in Palm Beach County, he's been arrested. He's been charged with 9 counts of voter registration fraud on behalf of the Republican Party, who paid millions of dollars to this company. And in the bargain, as the Florida law enforcement has wrapped up their 2-year investigation, they confirmed my reporting about this deceptive registration technique that Spruill's companies were using. And in the bargain of that, Nathan Spruill sends me an email saying, Florida law enforcement has proven that my company was not involved in voter registration fraud, which they didn't prove any such thing, but so therefore, take down your article, or you'll hear from my attorney.
Hmm.
Now, he didn't specify which article. He didn't say which one. He said your inaccurate story or something like that.
Hmm.
I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I don't know what was inaccurate. And in fact, Florida law enforcement has confirmed my reporting, not shown anything to be inaccurate. But this guy is doing some kind of thuggery to try to, you know, push back at our reporting at bradblog.com, our accurate, correct reporting. And I find it, frankly, pretty repulsive.
Yeah. It's interesting. In the at the top of the second hour of our program today, I had a debate with a conservative African-American talk show host who was making the argument that if you have to have ID to get on an airplane, you should have to have ID to vote. We have to make sure that our vote has high integrity. And now we're discovering that the same Republicans who are promoting these voter suppression ID laws are engaged in massive voter election, voter registration fraud. Is there any Democratic analogy to that? I know that, there was the allegation at one point that Acorn was inappropriately registering people, although my understanding is that none of that held up, that Acorn was clean as a whistle. They just got destroyed by Fox News and Mr. O'Keefe.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's never been any fraudulent vote that was or inappropriate vote that was, cast based on a fraudulent registration by one of the Acorn workers. I mean, in this case, you do have some similar cases in that the people who have been arrested working for this company state after state seem to have been working alone, seem to, in one sense, be defrauding Nathan Spruill's contractors. In fact, Spruill has told me that he thinks Acorn got a raw deal, that the Republicans were inappropriate in their attacks. But the difference was, A, Acorn wasn't hired by the Democratic Party. B, Acorn actually checked their registrations, confirmed them turning it in. When they found bad ones, they were the ones who turned them in. In this case, it was the Republican Party turning in these fraudulent registrations, and they didn't do, you know, they didn't check them first. So it's a very different case. And by the way, next time you have one of those right-wingers on telling you you need a photo ID to get on an airplane, right, please point them to the TSA website where you will find, no, you do not need a photo ID to get on an airplane. That's another lie from the Republican
Party. Really? What do you need?
Well, it'll make your life easier if you have one, but as you'll see at the TSA site, they say, hey, if you don't have a photo ID, you know, we'll still let you on a plane. We'll have to put you through some additional checks. We have databases we can check to make sure you're all right. But the commercial airlines are not about to turn away 30 million customers in this country.
Excellent point.
Just because they don't have photo ID.
Brad Friedman, you are brilliant, my friend. Bradblog.com. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, brother.
Keep up the great work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Brad Friedman is one of the best reporters out there, one of the best guys writing these days. Check out bradblog.com, B-R-A-D-B-L-O-G. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It is time to repudiate Reaganomics so the American middle class can make a comeback. There we go. Our daily take for today, just finishing up my editing on it. And Richard in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Richard, you wanted to talk about voter ID?
Yeah, first of all, I just wanted to call and say you're the best. African-American male, I'm calling from Chicago, and I wanted to, for all the African-American males who are listening, I don't think Tom has any doubt of what we're capable of doing and would never say that we're incapable of registering the vote or getting an ID like the guy from Blackosphere was trying to insinuate.
No, that's a straw man argument. He, you know, you set up a straw man and then knock it down. That's what he was trying to
do. Yeah, so I just wanted to say that and let you know, I think if anybody's had anybody's back, it's probably you. But the other thing is the voter registration. I kind of have a question. What can those of us in the neighboring state of Illinois, or what would you recommend that we do to help with voter registration or helping getting people out in Wisconsin? Because there's a lot of people that live in Wisconsin that work in Chicago or the northern suburbs of Illinois based on the companies that are there.
Right.
Any suggestions that you can put out that we might be able to do to help some of our
two very straightforward ones. Number one, contact your local Democratic Party and ask them. They would know who to contact and how to do it. Number two, MoveOn.org is pretty involved in this kind of thing. There are Progressive Democrats of America.org, PDAmerica.org as well. But then the second one would be to, if you have any affiliation whatsoever with any unions, contact that particular union and see if they're operating in Wisconsin and need any help. And if you have no affiliation with the unions, check out the AFL-CIO's program, where even if you're not a union member, you can join this group, Working America. I'm pretty sure it's workingamerica.org is the website, but it's called Working America, and it allows you to have access to AFL-CIO resources, and you get a newsletter and stuff like that, and it would be a point of entry, a point of communication with them. Make sense, Richard?
Makes total sense. Thanks for all you do, Tom.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling. Great to hear from you. David in Sacramento, California. Hey, David, you want to talk about police brutality?
Yes, I do. How you doing?
Good.
Boy, you don't get very people in Sacramento calling you.
Yeah. Well, from time to time, you know.
There's some stupid people in California. I mean, stupid people in Sacramento. They don't have no brain.
Yeah.
Progressive like you and I are. But anyway, here's the thing. What I don't understand is that this cop, the CHP, who basically resigned, so it's easier to resign as a cop-out rather than to fire the CHP and let him go ahead and still get his pension.
You're talking about the police officer who shot and killed the unarmed African-American driver who was just stopped because he wasn't wearing his seatbelt?
No, I'm talking about the CHP who actually beat the woman, an African-American, on the side of the freeway.
Oh, that one.
You know, they... they settled out her case for $1.5 million. They settled out her case, and he went ahead and they asked him for him to resign. So as this thing came out yesterday, as a result, they went ahead. He went ahead and resigned, and that just ticks me off. I mean, why can't they not fire the CHP, but yet it's okay for him to resign and continue to get his pension? What I think they should do, and I want America to hear this, why don't America put this on the ballot box that if a CHP or a cop makes a mistake, that we go after their pension instead of letting the taxpayer pay the $1.5 million settlement that the taxpayers have to fit the bill for?
Well, that's let me just be on the record as saying if a police officer, CHP or other, makes a mistake, I think that we need to back them up. If, on the other hand, they commit an act of violence that is unnecessary and unprovoked, which I think clearly this was the case here, this man just pounding this woman's, you know, thank God we had the video of it. That was no mistake. That was a crime.
Right,
there's a difference between a crime and a mistake.
Right, but how many cops in CHP has done that without video? They've done it without video.
Oh, they've been doing it and getting away with it. I go back and read Raymond Chandler's stuff, you know, writing about Los Angeles in the 1930s. They were doing it. This is as old as policing. And this is one of the reasons why we need to raise our policing standards. We need to raise the pay of our police officers, and we need to put a camera on the shoulder of every single cop in the country.
Right. No, I don't disagree with you, Tom. I just think that the fact is that a lot of times where a lot of cops don't like to be caught in the act, and I don't understand how they can ever go through the evaluation process. You know, they go through all the police academy, training, physical training, but they never get physically evaluated. There are people that are in jail right now who can't even get jobs that are probably better citizens than the cops are the ones that go through the training, who basically go through psychiatric evaluation, who go through the process but never get caught in the act for being psycho,
hitting
citizens.
That said, David, we can't turn this conversation into cop bashing. I mean, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of good people on police forces all across this country. They're there for the right reasons,
right,
and they're trying to do the right thing.
I agree with you. I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying the fact that there's some bad apples and there's some good apples. But also the bad apples out there that haven't been caught, they're still out there.
It works to everybody's benefit to weed out the bad apples and to modify the system in a way that it reduces the possibility that another bad apple gets a gun and a uniform and a stick. And, you know, I'm with you on that. And that's why I say, you know, not only raise the standards, but raise the level of accountability. And when people commit assault, whether it's under color of law or not, if it's assault, they should be prosecuted for assault. David, thank you for the call. Don in Lakeport, California. Hey, Don, you want to talk about voter fraud?
Yes. Brad covered pretty much everything I wanted to say. But when you talk to somebody about voter fraud, and bring up the electronic fraud, I mean, it's been proven that there's been more of that than any kind of voter fraud.
Yeah, starting in Alabama in 2002 with Don Siegelman losing the race overnight
while
he slept.
There's been thousands of people being caught doing that, changing that around, as opposed to, the 31 people and a billion votes that we actually, you know, found.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, just bring that up if you can next time. And the other thing, I've got an opinion about Democrats and Republicans. I think the Republicans have laser pointers and we're a bunch of dogs and cats, and they point to this wall, that wall, and we're jumping around from one thing to another. We need to stay with the one thing as far as the money in politics instead of going, because Democrats do, they want to fix everything all the time, whereas Republicans, all they're trying to do is keep money.
Yeah, no, I get it. And part of the problem with that is that the Republicans are well-organized and well-funded.
Yeah.
And as Will Rogers famously said, I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Organizing Democrats is like trying to herd cats. I kind of like that. I find that charming about the Democratic Party. On the other hand, it doesn't work well when you're trying to...
It doesn't get much solved. It really doesn't, because, everybody has their own idea about something.
On the other hand, though, if the Democratic Party became like the Republican Party, where when leadership says something, everybody salutes, and it's this way or the highway, I would no longer
want
to be affiliated with the Democratic Party to the very weak extent that I am to begin with. So it's one of those interesting things of the authoritarian personality being drawn to the Republican Party. Don, thanks for the call. Good food for thought. Kevin in Dedham, Massachusetts. Hey, Kevin. Voter ID?
So I'm calling about the voter fraud there, and you made mention of, you know, you went and picked up pharmaceutical stuff there. Well, I went to the pharmacy the other day to get some allergy medicine, and I had to show an ID to pick that up.
Well, that means that you were trying to buy a pharmacy medicine that's a precursor drug for methamphetamine. You were trying to buy Sudafed, basically.
Yeah, you're trying to get, right, exactly.
Right.
So I need to show an ID. Now, if I didn't show an ID, I wasn't getting the medicine.
Right, but there's a lot of other medicines that you could have gotten that work pretty much just as well with no ID.
We all use IDs. I mean, I'm 47 years old.
Right.
And, you know, when I was 22 years old, 25 years old, I used my ID all the time. Everywhere you went for a restaurant to have a drink or something like that, ID, please. ID, please. You go to the bank account. I agree. When you go to the bank now, when I opened up my account, I had to show an ID. Now you use your card there.
Right.
The company I work for, I don't have the same bank as them there. So if I go and cash my check, because I don't want it to go against my account, and I go to the bank that my company's check's on, I have to show an ID to cash the
but
check.
But, Kevin, the conversation that you and I are having is this dogs chasing their tail conversation that the Republicans want us to have, which is about whether or not people have IDs, whether or not people should show IDs. But the fact of the matter is that there is no problem in the United States with in-person voter fraud. And the reason why is very simple. It's in most states across the United States, it's a minimum of 2 years in prison. 2 years in prison for showing up and committing in-person voter fraud, for saying you're somebody who you're not. And nobody's willing to do that. There are more draconian penalties for voter fraud than there are for shoplifting.
But how do you check the person? I show up to vote.
You don't need to. You don't need to. You show up to vote, just like if you show up to be a witness in a trial. You show up and you say, "I am me, and I swear, I swear that I am me." Under.
I just did federal jury duty the other day. Had to show an ID.
Yeah.
I had to show an ID to walk into and then once I got up to the jury room, I had to show an ID again.
But we don't. Again, this is the discussion Republicans want us to have, and maybe you want us to have, Kevin. But the fact of the matter is that there is not a problem in this country of people who are not citizens voting. There is no problem. It does not exist. And so there's no need for even a conversation about what you need ID.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Instead, we need to be having a conversation about how Republicans are trying to suppress the vote. Why is it that they want 300,000 people in Wisconsin who don't have IDs not to be able to vote? Welcome back. Al, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Wyoming, Illinois. Hey, Al, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've got an idea possibly how these high school basketball and football recruits, the top in the country, how if they decided North Carolina and Florida would be off limits for them to play at, how millions of people in those states would get pretty mad if, say, like the NCAA or rather the NAACP, maybe their leaders went and talked to them personally and convince them to...
Yeah, here's the problem, Al. You're talking about young people at the beginning of basically a show business career, a sports career, and
exactly.
there's a lot on the line. There's sponsorships. There's a lot of money on the line, and all of those are good reasons for them not to do anything that could be perceived as political. So I think if we want to combat voter suppression laws, we have to, number one, point out that there is no crisis in America, and it's not even a problem in America of people voting illegally, of people voting who are not who they say they are. It's a non-problem, and nobody wants to risk 2 years in prison, and no illegal immigrant wants to risk being deported.
I understand all that, but it's a non-issue. I'm just also saying that you could spin Florida and North Carolina to blue if these people thought that they were going to Duke and North Carolina were not going to have winning programs in basketball.
Yeah.
I think people would get irate.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. It's just I'm not sure that we can expect our athletes to be leading the charge, although it would be nice.
Well, why not? That's who they're hurting is young black athletes.
I get it. Although, once
they started the war.
Right. Once
they started it.
Yeah. Okay.
Can't we finish it?
Al, thanks for the call. It's an interesting suggestion. Steve in Utica, New York. Hey, Steve. College students?
Hey. Hi, Tom. I was wondering, I grew up in the 60s and 70s.
I'm listening,
and,
Steve.
I'm wondering what's going on with the colleges today that are not speaking out about what's happening.
I think there's a fair amount of activism going on our college campuses right now, Steve. For example, in Colorado, you've got a bunch of students, Monday, Tuesday this week, who walked out of classes because the school board, the state school board, had been taken over by some Koch brothers funded right wing, 3-2 now. They put three Republicans on the board, and they said, let's stop teaching the history of the civil rights movement. Let's stop teaching the history of the suffrage movement. Let's stop teaching the history of slavery. Let's stop teaching the history of the American genocide of the Native Americans. Let's stop teaching all these things that look like conflict and that encourage people to question authority. And instead, let's teach a curriculum that encourages a respect for authority and free market capitalist principles, right? In other words, billionaires are good. Billionaires are wonderful. We need fewer regulations. They want to change the curriculum. And the students are saying, hey, wait a minute, dissent is the essence of patriotism. And we're not going to put up with this crap. And so, a lot of young people are standing up, Steve. It's not like it was in the 60s. It's not the draft. But I think in larger numbers every day, we're seeing young people show up. And I'm quite impressed by this generation coming up. We'll be right back. Guest on voter fraud said, just Google voter fraud. So Matt Googled voter fraud, and he says, all voting systems face threats of some form of electoral fraud. That's the electoral fraud for the wiki page. Then the second one, news for voter fraud. Illinois Republicans stand behind candidate who was involved with voter fraud, apparently. Mass voter registration in Georgia brings accusations of voter registration fraud. Probe looms over tight Georgia race. Right. Yeah, this is an effort to register minority voters. So the Republicans are screaming, fraud, fraud. The Brennan Center for Justice, myth of voter fraud. U.S. News and World Report, is voter fraud a real problem? No, it's not. ABC News, voter fraud news. And on it goes. So there's that. I got an interesting email from Joe Sestak. He's running against Mr. Toomey, of course, Senator Toomey. Toomey says, you don't have to look at what I say. You can look at what I did. Toomey says, backlog in veteran benefit claims is unacceptable. But Toomey voted against annual funding for the VA every year, including funding the Veterans Claims Intake Program. He voted against $2.5 billion for more efficient benefits and processing technology and training. And it just goes on and on. He voted against Alzheimer's. He spoke in favor of it. He voted against small business. He voted in favor of them. He spoke against shutting down the government. He voted in favor of it. It just goes on and on. And then finally, do you still believe in the American dream? Do you still believe that if you work hard, you'll get ahead? We are down now to 55% of men who believe this. Excuse me. It was 55% in 2012. 2 years later, it's 48%. 51% of women in 2012 said yes. Now it's 37%. Among young people, it's down to 40%. 18 to 29. It's really quite remarkable. Kurt in Los Angeles. Hey, Kurt.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again. I got a couple things about this voter ID guest you had on earlier. And first thing I want to say is that the Republican Party is always touting the Constitution as their mantra for doing most of what they do, and twist it and turn it around against the American people. And so I would like to take a page out of their playbook, and I would like to ask your guest if I'd had a chance to. Where in the Constitution does it say anything about a driver's license? Because as far as I know, the first automobile wasn't built till 1905, about 140 years after the Constitution, you know. And so, you know, if there was automobiles rolling around in 1776, I'd like to know why we've been lied to all this time, you know, because it doesn't make any sense. Because for them to create a mechanism that can be easily fraudulized, as your second guest said, then you got a Republican group out there falsifying registration on people. So they're going and they're getting Democrats thinking to register, and then they're throwing away their ballot. So when they show up, they're not even registered.
Right. Okay. And if you look at the 24th Amendment to the Constitution, which was passed in 1964, most people forget that we did this. We actually had to amend the Constitution to say that poll taxes were illegal. And I would submit to you that if you have to get an ID, even if the ID is free, if you have to pay $100 for your birth certificate to get that ID, that's a poll tax. And here's what the 24th Amendment says. The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax. And
exactly.
Yeah, and I would say that these IDs are just a poll tax and drag. That's all it is. It's a poll tax in disguise. Kurt, thank you for the call. Well said. Very well said. Janice in Minneapolis. Hey, Janice, thanks for listening to 950 AM. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm just wondering, since we have restrictions on what we have to do to be able to vote, why don't we have restrictions on the companies and their free speech rights? They should be based in the United States. They should pay taxes here. Their majority of their stockholders should be citizens.
You mean before they support political candidates?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, the so-called free speech right of these corporations. Excellent point, Janice. Right. Excellent point. Thank you for making it. Les in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. Hey, Les, thanks for listening to 92.1 FM, The Mic. What's up?
Absolutely, Tom, and thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to lay out the scenario that I'm going to run up against with this voter ID criminal restriction that Scott Walker has imposed on us. I manage two apartment complexes that cater to senior citizens and disabled people. I was going to arrange for caravans that can carry people in wheelchairs to go to the polls for the November 4th election. I now, however, will not do that because I know that 197 of the 201 seniors that I will be taking to the polls will be denied their right to vote because they won't have the proper papers. They certainly don't have driver's licenses. They don't have a photo ID because most of them have not driven for 4 decades.
Yeah.
And
Les, would you please call your local Democratic Party and see if you can get anybody at any kind of senior level on the line about this and see if this is something that they could run with?
Well, my Democratic Party representative is Mike Tate. He's the head of the Democratic Party here. And they don't know what to do. We've talked, and I was a featured speaker at our Democratic convention last month talking about this. But there's nothing at this point. And you have to remember that we operate these caravans out of Medicaid money.
Right.
Walker just turned back the Medicare and Medicaid money. I don't have the money now to run the caravans.
Amazing. So Scott Walker is really succeeding in suppressing the vote of the 200 senior citizens that you have.
Yes, it's a perfect storm that we're facing here. He's got it covered, a la the Koch brothers, every which way to Sunday, Tom.
Amazing.
We are screwed.
Les, thank you for the call. I'm sorry to hear that. It's amazing what's happening in this country. Thanks for being with us today, and don't forget, democracy ain't a spectator sport. It requires you to show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.